Let's have a great show, guys.
What are you all doing?
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The last time we gathered, we said that it was difficult to tell whether public support for impeaching President Trump was still growing. We didn't have any recent high-quality polls at the time, but we've gotten some polls since then, and it does not look good for the president. So we're going to take a look at those and also review some of the main developments in the impeachment inquiry during the last week. There's also a Democratic primary debate this Tuesday. It's going to be a cramped 12-person stage, but right now the race actually looks like a two-person competition. So what are the current contours of the Democratic primary, and what's at stake in the fourth debate? And here with me to discuss, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going well.
Good to hear.
Thank you.
Also with us is senior politics writer, Clem Malone. Hey there.
Hey,
how are you?
I'm good.
And managing editor, Micah Cohen.
Hello.
How are you?
Very nice.
Awesome. Happy Monday. And before we dig in, I wanted to give a shout out to the 538 sports podcast, Hot Takedown. You should already be listening, but if you aren't familiar with Hot Takedown, it's our sports podcast. They discussed the conflict between kind of the NBA and China over Hong Kong last week. So if you're interested in sports and geopolitics, a good thing to check out. We're actually going to put a teaser of that conversation at the end of this episode. Nate, I think you joined them last week.
I was talking about our new stat, which is called Raptor. It was kind of my fight against the dying of the light, where now I have to just cover politics for the next 13 months. But it's a really cool new NBA stat, and there's a good discussion about that. And we'll be using that prominently in our forecasts and so forth this year.
And you may see some point in the near future a video of Nate Silver wearing a dinosaur costume online.
Which we do not believe is actually a raptor dinosaur.
Oh, really?
I think it was a T-Rex.
It looked like a raptor.
I mean, you know.
The raptor thing is proof that you can get someone to do anything if their name's on the site.
Nate deserves kudos.
For the costume, I mean.
Yeah. It was not just a costume. It was like a blow-up costume where they had to pump air into it. So he was like a full-size dinosaur.
It actually like kind of counted as a workout because you have to like lumber around in this rather
hot. Was it heavy?
Yeah, it's pretty heavy.
Fun story. When I was a kid, broke my nose while pretending to be a raptor.
Okay.
All right. And with that, let's talk about impeachment polling. And let's actually begin with one of our favorite questions, good use of polling or bad use of polling. And here's the situation. So last week, Fox News released a poll showing that 51% of Americans support impeaching and removing President Trump. 40% were opposed, and then 4% said that he should be impeached but not removed. Anyway, Trump and his supporters were not pleased with this poll and attempted to discredit it. And the New York Post published a piece saying, and here's a quote, pollster Braun Research, which conducted the survey, noted 48% of its respondents were Democrats. But the actual breakdown of party affiliation is 31% Democrat, 29% Republican, and 38% Independent, according to Gallup. A poll weighted for party affiliation would have concluded that 44.9% favored impeachment and 44.4% opposed it. End of quote. Nate, is that a good use of polling or a bad use of polling?
This is one of the stupidest articles I've ever read in a mainstream publication about polling. And by the way, what's Kellyanne Conway's role officially? She retweeted this.
Senior advisor to the president, something like that.
She probably ought to know better.
Oh, she knows better.
Because she is a pollster.
She's a pollster.
It's worse for her. If she doesn't know better, then it's really a problem because then she's incompetent.
Right, okay,
I'm assuming she's just being deceitful.
Let's walk people through why.
First of all, the whole premise is absurd, right? What party you believe in, or not believe in, what party you prefer or identify with, those are, by the way, different things, kind of which party I'm registered with, which I'm identify with, and which I lean toward. That's one of the things polls want to ask about. It's not fixed in time. You can change your party registration. Many states don't have party registration. And it's something that varies. If Trump pisses a lot of traditional Republicans off, then you might see more independents or something next time, right? That's issue number one. Issue number two is that even to the extent that maybe party identification is more stable, there's no gold standard for it, right? So to say, oh, Gallup says this, this other poll says that, well, there's no inherent way to know who's right. But there's a more kind of important issue in this case, which is that Fox News, their pollsters, ask people to lean toward a party if they say they're independents. So if you say, I'm an independent, well, we all know that a lot of independents really mostly lean up on one side or the other. they'll say, do you lean toward Democrats or Republicans? And the number they report, the 48% or whatever, is the lean party ID. I think it was like leaned 48% Democrat and 40% Republican, which is a fairly typical gap, that 8-point party ID gap. By the way, there are more Democrats than Republicans in most polls for a long period of time.
But the Gallup numbers don't include leaners, is what you're saying.
The Gallup numbers don't include leaners, so it's just an absurd critique.
Is that ever a thing to be skeptical about if you see a poll where it seems like one party is oversampled or undersampled?
I think if you never looked at the party ID crosstabs in a poll, you'd be smarter for it. Like, literally, don't go there.
Wait, so how do they make sure that they get an even mix? Because you wait for other things like race or education or things like that,
right? So first of all, a lot of pollsters... let me take that back. A lot of pollsters that do not use traditional random sampling, meaning a lot of online pollsters who are very smart online pollsters, okay, but they use party ID as a crutch because they don't know they're getting a random sample. Ideally, you get a random sample based on the overall population of the electorate, that we know that 14% of voters in whatchamacallit county are African American, and 51% are women, and 26% are under the age of 34, and whatever else, right? And so you weight based on demographic trends, because demographic trends are
stable, like people don't change on those.
Are things. Hard. I mean, if you want to get to really esoteric discussions, some people can change the way they identify.
Okay.
But putting that aside, what gender you identify with or what race is like 99% stable from one survey to the next. And so therefore, that's what you want to wait on, is hard and fast demographic characteristics. Because otherwise, the problem is, like, if there's a big shift in party identification, there was a big shift between 2004 and 2008 when people were really fed up with George Bush and a lot of Republican identifiers went and became independents and a lot of independents became Democrats. You saw a reversion from that shift in Obama's first term. But if you miss the big change and you assume things are baked in, especially at a time when things are changing because of impeachment, for example, then you defeat the whole purpose of polling. So my best signal for whether someone is a sophomoric analyzer of polling is the extent to which they are worried about party ID and the crosstabs. I mean, people are like, well, it shows the enumeracy. No, it shows the stupidity of everyone involved in the New York Post with writing and editing this story. It shows the stupidity
Yes, let's take them to task, but also I think a lot of people could be confused by that. So yes, maybe it's irresponsible of the New York Post to do that, but what's our antidote to that, right? To be a smart reader, what's the bottom line? What's the takeaway for people being a smart reader of these polls?
I think Nate's advice to just not worry about the crosstabs 99.9% of the time is the best advice. It's just not worth your mental energy to get wrapped up in that. But I do think, to Claire's point, that it's worth separating out, you know, whether this is a bad faith argument on the part of the Post or just incompetence, we should take them to task because they should know better. And pollsters like Kellyanne Conway or a lot of people who make this argument, often it's a bad faith argument. They know better. News consumers, on the other hand, I could easily see getting confused on this. It's not obvious why it's so stupid. So I think it helps in these kind of discussions to explain why it is stupid. I mean, it's the equivalent of saying, like, oh, here's a poll. You should weight this poll towards Trump approval numbers, right? Which doesn't make any sense because Trump approval number can change in the same way that party identification can change.
Yeah, so, there aren't a fixed number of Democrats and Republicans. And Anna, we probably differ on the extent to which we advocate kind of a happy warrior versus a tough love, more critical mentality. But I do think when you have like so many crosstabs, it's not just party ID, you can always find something in the poll that you don't like.
Yeah.
And by the way, the best thing to do is to take an average of polls. It is true that the Fox News poll showed, I think, just about the highest numbers for impeachment support out of any poll that came out last week, right? So what you can say is like, hey, look, for any one of a number of reasons ranging from the question wording to the random sample that Fox happened to draw, because you can randomly in a poll of 800 people happen to get more people who are pro-impeachment or more Democrats. That's the right and proper way to do a poll, is to account for the margin of error. And so a lot of the time when people are doing like fancy unskewing things, it's just like, okay, look at the polling average. And if the polling average is lower, then I don't really care that
this
much.
Wasn't even that much of an outlier.
Yeah, so let's do that. How does this compare to our polling average? It said 51% in favor of impeachment.
So according to our tracker, and remember, we're lumping a bunch of different types of polls together. We're going to start differentiating soon. But right now, it basically shows 50% support, 44% don't support impeachment. So support impeachment is just about at a majority, a very slim majority, but a majority.
And how much has public opinion changed over the past week or so? Because the last time we met, it had been kind of stagnant.
I think public opinion has changed to some degree. So, okay, there are clearly two phases. Phase number one is that Pelosi and the Democrats came out for an impeachment inquiry that seemed to produce a reasonably large shift that was concentrated among Democrats. A few days later, various evidence, some of it released by the White House, came out that put the president in a bad light. In Ukraine, that seemed to produce a further shift, which was mostly among independents. The question is, like, whether there's been a further shift still on top of that, now that we're, what, like 3 weeks into the story? And the answer is, I think, more likely than not, the numbers are still going up. I mean, if you look at our tracker, it's, as Micah said, this is an amalgam of different types of questions. So depending on which question you ask, but like that amalgam, for whatever it's worth, 49.8/44, call it 50/44. If you go back a week ago to when we last hit the podcast, 46.5% support, 44.7% don't support. So what seems to be happening is that like the support number is slightly going up. The don't support number is kind of steady now, right? Which might make sense. Maybe some people, because there still are some Democrats, still like, you know, 16% of Democrats do not yet support impeachment, which is a fair number not to support impeachment, right?
So and on the other hand, you have 14% of Republicans supporting and 45% of independents.
Yeah, part of me wonder if that GOP number might go back down, maybe, potentially.
All right, so let's get into what actually happened in the week since we last discussed. Claire, can you talk about some of the major developments? You actually wrote about this for the website on Friday. You have a new column called The Spin Cycle, discussing how the parties are reacting to the news and so on. So what happened? if you can...
This feels unfair.
In one sentence, what happened, Claire?
A lot of people decided to talk.
Yeah.
We saw the former ambassador to Ukraine testifying. We saw some leaks coming out that Sondland is, contrary to the State Department's orders, going to testify and say that Trump told him to say there was no quid pro quo. We saw two of Rudy Giuliani's associates be arrested for campaign finance violations. These are guys who had ties to Ukraine and sort of Giuliani's investigations in Ukraine. Congressional Democrats sent a bunch of basically subpoena notices to the White House, and the White House counsel sent back in a sort of nasty letter that said, no, we will not be complying with this constitutionally illegitimate investigation, which is quite a spicy response. In that context, that made Sondland's decision to testify sort of all the more interesting.
And that's the U.S. ambassador to the EU.
Correct. The guy who was in the text messages that we talked about last week and the one who said there was no quid pro quo. We should discuss this on the telephone and not via text message.
Call me.
I think that those are the big ones, but, you know, forgive me, I might have forgotten. And just the column that I'll be writing is the point of it is basically to keep track of these things, these happenings, but also how congressional Democrats are spinning it, how presidential candidates on the trail are spinning things. And basically just to keep track of what's moving, say, those polls that favor or don't favor impeaching President Trump.
The last time we discussed the Republican spin, it seemed somewhat muddled. Has a clear strategy or message emerged over the past week?
I think that the White House counsel's letter is a pretty good distillation, which is basically that Trump and congressional Democrats are saying this is, A, not a legitimate constitutional investigation into Trump, but they're also saying that this is Democrats' attempt to negate the results of the 2016 election, which the Trump campaign has turned into a 2020 election campaign ad. So basically they are stalling, calling it unconstitutional, and telling their voters this is an attempt to negate your vote. Vote for us in 2020.
And has the Democratic strategy line changed at all? I guess we've heard more from Republicans.
So I would say that the Democrats, the big line has been the facts speak for themselves. So I would say it's a sort of, there's been a lot of movement, noise from the Republican side of things. Democrats have been a little bit more just the facts, ma'am, kind of thing. We think the facts speak for themselves.
There was some polling. I'm trying to, as we search here in real time, figure out who did this polling. I'm going to attribute it, maybe wrong, but there was polling saying, of people who don't support impeachment, why not? And it was done by a liberal-leaning firm and had kind of an optimistic interpretation for Democrats, which is that actually a lot of people who are not for impeachment right now just want to see more evidence. And there are not that many people who currently fall into the, yeah, this is bad, but, you know, we have an election, so we don't need impeachment camp. It was more people who want to see more evidence. So that would be a bullish finding for Democrats because it means they could persuade people potentially. But when do you think, like, let me ask a funny question. What do you predict?
Haha, funny.
When do you guys predict will be the first podcast, full Monday podcast, that we do not explicitly have an impeachment segment? How long will this stay in the news?
March.
Wow.
No, I bet. I bet.
No, like around November.
November.
Wait, so
late November. Late November.
If they want to try to bring articles of impeachment,
we will do a podcast that is purely like Iowa focused, polling focused, Democrat focused, and we won't really talk about
it. It'll be tomorrow because we're going to do a debate reaction pod, and we're not going to talk about impeachment.
Well, now we are.
I said a Monday podcast.
I don't. But if they're bringing articles of impeachment by December and trying to vote on them before the end of the year, right? So it's. You would imagine it'd be through the end of the year. Anyway, you had something to say, Micah. Go ahead.
I was just thinking about you dressing up like a raptor or something.
No, we didn't dress up. My sister and I would just pretend we were raptors, which involved pushing your head back and then thrusting it forward.
How old were you?
Well,
18.
Well, let's not get into that. Okay, so a few thoughts. One is right now, the result Nate just cited about there's lots of people who are just waiting to see more evidence. It rings true to me. You know, impeachment was unpopular through all of the Russia investigation. All of a sudden, we get a new story, new evidence with Ukraine, and support for impeachment rises. In other words, it tracks with new evidence. So that rings true to me. But where that evidence is coming from and in what form is super interesting. So like Sondland, the EU ambassador, who in those text messages, and I think in the public portfolio about him, comes off as a pro-Trump acolyte. He had been slated to testify. Then the White House said in the letter Claire mentioned, okay, we're not going to cooperate at all. But then reporting came out over the weekend that apparently he will reportedly tell the House committee that that text message, you know, the press release style text message he sent saying there are no quid pro quo of any kind, blah, 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 blah. He was like, he will reportedly tell Congress, hey, I don't know if that's true. That's just what Trump told me. That's not like incredibly damning for Trump. It's not exactly like friendly testimony, though, either. Concurrently, we're also expecting testimony. And again, all this is behind closed doors. So we're just like relying on reporting on it from Fiona Hill, who was the top Russia advisor, I think, on the NSC, no longer
to Trump.
To Trump. Right. And she will reportedly testify that Sondland, Giuliani, Volcker were sort of running a shadow Ukraine policy outside of the normal systems and processes in the U.S. government, which, again, that's not great for the Trump administration. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, we are still very early in this process. You've essentially had only two people actually testify so far, a little reporting on number three and number four witnesses, and everything's been pretty freaking bad for Trump so far. So, like, if there's a bunch of voters standing by waiting for new evidence, that could be really bad. It seems like we're getting a lot of fairly damning evidence for the administration.
I want to ask a somewhat complicated question about how Syria potentially plays into all of this. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by DoorDash. Long day at work, tough day at school, still stuck at the office, treat yourself to the meal you deserve and have your favorite restaurants come to you with DoorDash. DoorDash connects you to your favorite restaurants in your city. Ordering is easy, just open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food will be delivered to you wherever you are. Not only is your favorite pizza joint already on DoorDash, but there are over 340,000 restaurants in 3,300 cities, so you might find a new favorite too. With door-to-door delivery in all 50 states and Canada, order from your local go-tos or choose from your favorite national restaurants. Don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code POLITICS. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code POLITICS. Don't forget, that's promo code POLITICS for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Quip. What actually makes a better toothbrush? industrial strength power, claims of miraculous trendy ingredients, multiple modes. If you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use it. That's why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health, healthier habits. Quip's sensitive vibrations with a built-in timer guide gentle brushing for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with 30-second pulses, ensuring an even clean. Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for clean new bristles right on schedule. The sleek, intuitive design is simple to use and comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount. Quip starts at just $25, and you'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/538. It's a simple way to support our show and start brushing better, but you have to go to getquip.com/538, the numbers, not the letters, to get your first refill free. Go right now to getquip.com/538. All right, we're back, and in the week since we last met, the United States withdrew from Syria, Turkey began bombing northeastern Syria and going to war against the Kurds, and there has been a lot of backlash from Congress in general, but, you know, most notably from Republicans. So this is backlash to something distinct from impeachment, but does the fact that Republicans are breaking with Trump on this say anything about how this impeachment inquiry and the politics of impeachment could unfold going forward?
I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, so let me make the argument, yeah. Then you make the counterargument. One, I think it shows they are willing to break with Trump on some things. So that's like a low bar, but they clear that bar.
And this right? is like everybody. It's like Mitch McConnell. It's yeah. Liz Cheney. It's all kinds of leaders within the congressional delegation.
Now, in this case, it's like a fairly inexplicable Trump decision that happened outside, again, outside the normal process. John Dickerson made this point on the political gabfest, but like there actually are some similarities, at least in the process that led to impeachment within the administration and the process that led to the Syria decision. But anyway, it shows, okay, Republicans do have a line somewhere, right? In this case, like literally people are dying as a result of the decision. So maybe you're not going to see that with regards to impeachment, but still there is a line. And two, I think it's related in the sense of for some elected Republicans, I think there is a calculus of, hey, we don't like X, Y, and Z that Trump does, but we get A, B, and C. And the more that Trump undermines A, B, and C, and elected officials don't feel like they're getting that anymore, I think that maybe eats away at his support among his Republican colleagues.
What is A, B, and C? Just electoral success?
Electoral success, tax cuts, you know. Sorry, Nate?
I whispered policy.
Yeah, it's policy stuff, right? And how much that factors into their support for Trump, I think that's probably where Claire will push back, as opposed to just a straight electoral politics of them needing to stand by him.
I'm not going to like profess to know what's going to happen. Yeah. My instinct is...
Oh, because I know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. My instinct is that Republicans are taking this bold stand in part because their constituents aren't keeping a close eye on this.
Yeah.
And I do think all that you said is right, Micah. These Republicans probably feel, a lot of them have probably met with at least some people involved with this fight. There's a sense of we are abandoning these people who have basically been fighting our battles on ISIS and been watching the prisoners and, you know, ISIS prisoners for us. And that there feels like some true, like, human betrayal going on that Trump kind of allowed. I really do wonder, though, like, let's say they want to break with Trump and they want to use this as an excuse with their base, right? Is that relevant to their base? Or would Trump be able to make some argument that would be more clear for people to grasp onto? And so Republicans, we want to stand up for the Kurds, would kind of like fall flat. I mean, the PKK, which this Kurdish movement is now sort of looking for an alliance with Bashar al-Assad, right? So that's not...
Yeah.
I could see maybe that's pertinent, or maybe, I don't know.
All like, these stories about ISIS detainees now having escaped in the chaos.
Right. What if there's an attack and God forbid, right?
Yeah.
But like, you know, these things have very much moved political events in Europe and the U.S. But I have real skepticism that a foreign policy thing like this will give Republicans the cover, because unfortunately, Americans are pretty parochial and don't pay as much attention to foreign policy.
I look at it more broadly, and I think you're right that this on its own, for most of the Republican base, would not be enough if officials went to that base and said, okay, here's why we're abandoning Trump, right? But I look at it, I guess, more kind of holistically.
Like an accumulation of both the impeachment stuff and this.
Exactly. Okay. So impeachment is starting. We're starting impeachment with Trump unpopular overall. Impeachment has a bare majority of support, very slim, or maybe a plurality, a strong plurality. Democrats are almost all on board with it. Independents are split but moving towards Democrats. And Republican officials are making nonsensical arguments in support of Trump, staying silent, or, you know, some other random thing. So if that's where we're starting, the more stuff there is like Syria, which sort of just eats away at the reasons Republicans do like Trump and adds to the general sense of like, what the f*** is going on with this administration? I think that adds up and adds up and adds up. And that's how you get to something as extreme as removing someone from office.
I mean, there's like, maybe there is a third dimension that you and Claire are kind of dancing around a little bit, right? Where number one is like, there's a policy dimension. If Trump does stuff you don't like, he starts a trade war with China,
yeah,
et cetera. He changes foreign policy in ways you don't like. That's a problem, right? Number two, and probably should be number one in terms of how most members of Congress think, is the electoral impact. What risk do you bear by going against Trump? What risk would the party bear in either direction if Trump were somehow removed from office, or not somehow removed, if you voted to remove Trump from office, right? What's that do to like the GOP's chances of winning, keeping the Senate and winning the presidency in 2020? But there is this kind of like third dimension of like, might people be concerned about the president's overall fitness for office?
What people?
Republicans.
Yeah. Republican
and
voters
in
general.
And you can say it boils down to, you know.
But you have to prove to people, I mean, like, what is he doing differently than what he's been doing for the past 3 years?
I think it's a lot worse. Subjectively, I think.
You,
like,
well, sure, you,
I think
you
the,
do.
I think the Syria thing is, and I think, again, you can listen to this podcast. I think a lot of times we said, yeah, this blah, 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 right? I remember like sending out a tweet on New Year's Day in 2017 saying, hey, look, if you had actually lined up like a liberal critic's list of what the first year of Trump is going to be like and compare it to what actually happened, then I actually don't think that it would have been as bad if liberals had to be objective about it in advance,
okay, but
as what happened. This year is kind of in line with the stuff that there was that fake like Boston Globe series of headlines about Trump and all the stuff that happens. I think the further you've gotten along in Trump's presidency, the closer it gets to like this kind of Boston Globeized version
okay,
of Trump.
Okay, I understand the argument that you're making, and that might be true. But also there's the other thing of, this is just what people expect his decision-making process to be, and perhaps that there isn't that shock that you would think that there would be, right? It's all boiled down to Trump goes out on the White House lawn and says, well, why doesn't China investigate Biden, and blah, 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 right? The idea that in order to cover up conduct unbecoming or unfit for office, he repeats the same conduct over and over again. I don't know, Nate, but I'm just hypothesizing that there are two ways that plays out.
I'm saying he's playing a higher stakes game. The stakes of the Syria decision, for example, are, to me, you can write hate letters if you want, about 100 times more important than like the Muslim travel ban in the first year in terms of the impact on the world and the impact on, you know, the future security of large numbers of people.
So when you were saying maybe there's a concern about fitness for office, who are you talking about? Are you talking about Republican voters or are you talking about lawmakers?
I'm talking about lawmakers saying, hey, do I have to put up with at least another 13 months of unpredictable, to use a fairly kind euphemism, decision making from the White House? And so how do I know there won't be another crisis kind of around the next corner?
But aren't those lawmakers only really moved to act if those sort of more, not the hardcore Trump supporter people, but the other Republicans, if they move against Trump, right? Isn't that the only thing that these Republican lawmakers are truly reacting to?
I mean, at the end of the day, they would react if they think that Trump is more of an electoral liability than a feature.
Has anything changed recently to make you think that?
I think I'm with Nate in the regards that I do think there is a sense that Trump's behavior has been more, whatever adjective you want to use, outlandish, unbalanced, whatever, since the Ukraine story broke. Kind of his public rhetoric has been pretty all over the place. And then look, I think ultimately Claire is right that the politics of this are going to be what matters most. They may not be the only thing that matters, but it's going to be what matters most. There was a poll from our friends at Ipsos and our colleagues at ABC News that found, to Claire's point, only like 17% of people were very surprised or somewhat surprised by the Ukraine story, right? So a lot of this is already baked in. But I do think that the political calculation for Republicans can change and the politics of this can get worse for them without the GOP base abandoning Trump. So one, it's the voters Claire mentioned, those kind of more marginal Trump supporters, the people who didn't like him in 2016 but still voted for him, you know, more educated Republicans who live in suburbs, blah, 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 right? Those people for one. But also, like, I don't think it's true that Mitch McConnell in the Senate, for example, can or is just ignoring what non-Republicans think. So the more that Trump makes decisions that are near universally criticized, like this decision on Syria, the more it just hurts Trump's standing.
Here's my bottom line thing, is that I think it's unlikely that Republican lawmakers and Republican voters in general turn against Trump before the election, in part because people don't like being told that they're wrong. Trump is very smart in framing the 2020 campaign as they want to attack the decision that you made in 2016. I mean, look at all of us at various points on this podcast, right? We like dig into our arguments, our stance. And I just think it comes down to like this really human thing of, even if it strategically might start to make more sense, there's this real mental emotional barrier to people saying you made the wrong choice. And in the position of Republican Party leaders, they have given their party to Trump, right? They have remade it in his image. And to admit that Trump is impeachable means not just, oh, he did a couple of really crazy things that went over the line. It means we've made a huge mistake.
Yeah. So let's cap this off in a somewhat, this is all like a complex conversation and all of these different dynamics will play out and we'll keep talking about them. But to put a clean 538 button on this, I'm going to tell you what the current betting markets say are the likelihood of impeachment and removal. And you tell me at this point if you think that...
Buy, sell, hold.
Buy, sell, hold, basically. All right. According to Predict It today, there is a 72% chance of Trump being impeached in his first term.
I'd buy that. That seems a little low.
It seems low. Let me point one thing out, though, which is that under that contract, Trump would not be impeached if he resigned the office beforehand. So if something really bad came out, I don't know what that would be. If Sondland was like, yeah, actually, I have a recording of an explicit quid pro quo from the White House. Anyway, I think 71% seems kind of low. A majority of Democrats have come out for, or a majority of the House has come out for an impeachment inquiry. It seems like there are very few true fence sitters anymore. I think it would be quite strange if all this evidence comes out in the first 3 weeks. Democrats are on record as saying they want an impeachment inquiry. And then enough of them peel off and say, okay, we're not going to go through with it.
Right.
I mean, I can imagine Democrats screwing things up, but I don't think there's a 30% chance of that plus things being so bad that he doesn't even go through with the House.
So buy, it's a buy. Claire, are you a buy, sell, or a hold?
I don't know.
You don't bet. Don't all right. Micah, you're a buy.
Claire's a buy.
Let's wrap this up with the likelihood of being convicted in the Senate in his first term, which would mean removal. Okay, so according to Predict It, there's a 19% chance. The highest it's ever been was 22%. Buy, sell, hold.
They're not going to do it.
So Claire's a sell.
She's selling at 20%, at 19%.
Okay. This is actually kind of tricky because I think the chances that they will do it are much higher than I would have ever believed 4 months ago or whatever, 3 months ago.
But that much higher may still be 20%.
They're not going to do it.
But the much higher might be 10% or 5% even. What's the number again?
19%.
I would sell that, but honestly, I'm at like 14-15%.
Yeah, the classic 538. Actually, that's actually, just about 0.3%.
Clearly 17, not 19. No, I hate
buy sell hold. I really do because I think it obscures the issue. Right?
It does. No, it forces you to actually.
No, I think
articulate
it's
a position, Claire.
I can articulate my position without the Scottish teens.
I think it's also interesting to just see what the broader public thinks about this. Like one in five.
Right, but I don't think that on this stuff that like the people who are who are setting these markets are indicative of the general public.
I mean, so look, you also have two scenarios here, right? You have...
With the betting market?
With the removal.
Oh.
You have scenario one, which is that of the current Ukraine story, actually the ball gets rolling in a way that there are dynamic shifts in public opinion and he gets impeached based on that. That's one scenario. There's also like something else that is not currently in the purview happens.
Why do you keep adding these complicating footnotes?
If we're talking about distinguishing, okay, so I'll say it. What if the reasons that Trump pulled out of Syria had to do with business dealings he has with international actors, right?
In like, Turkey.
That, I think, could actually get him removed. I don't know what the chance of that is. It's not zero, though.
Okay, so that's going off on a limb based on something that we don't have any evidence
but
about yet.
Galen, it's your segment.
But also, like, I understand that your like general outlook on something as like high risk as impeachment or removal is it's high variability and we should have an open mind about all of the different things that could happen. And so, I mean, I hear that. But based on that, are you buy, sell, or hold? Because you're the only person who hasn't told me yet.
At 19, I guess I'm a sell. At 15, I might be a hold.
Okay.
Nate copied me.
We got to talk about the Democratic debate on Tuesday. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources. And that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desktop or phone. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, at netsuite.com/538. That's netsuite.com/538, the numbers, not the letters, to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, netsuite.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35. And once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, just prescription solutions backed by science. No more awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. 4hims connects you with real doctors online, which could save you hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last, and that's subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's FORHIMS.com/538. 4hims.com/538. We're back, and on Tuesday, Democratic contenders for the 2020 presidential nomination will face off in their fourth debate. It will be one night with 12 people, and the two candidates joining since last month's debate are Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii and billionaire and impeachment advocate Tom Steyer. So to kind of like set the stakes broadly here, how important do you guys think the debates have been so far in determining the contours of the race? Have they played a significant role in the first three debates?
I think they've helped people discern who is serious and who is not serious. You know, for someone like Buttigieg, they've probably been good on some level because it's like he's kind of unknown, but he's being taken seriously. He comes across well, blah, blah, blah. For someone like Biden, I think it's given some people doubts about his ability to... I want to be careful here. He's not a good talker sometimes, off the cuff in these settings, in these pressure settings. So it's probably led people to have like a more unfavorable opinion of him. But yeah, I don't think we should dismiss debates at all. Like, they are nationally televised events at which people, most Americans don't see these candidates at all. So getting an impression of them is probably good. And like, I would say for someone like Warren, who has spent a lot of her time sort of trying to introduce herself to the American public by kind of saying, like, listen, I'm not Hillary Clinton, even though I am a woman of a certain age, of a certain party, and look, I'm not so scary. It has shaped the conversation in that way. is what I would say as a kickoff. Now everyone disagrees. All right,
yeah,
with me.
Where do you guys come down?
No, I think that's right. I mean, look, the debates have not had an effect like they did in the 2012 Republican primary.
Like everybody gets a bump.
Everybody gets a bump and a surge, or like there has not been a moment like there was in the 2016 Republican primary where like Rubio has this horrible debate moment and then is out of the race 2 weeks later or whatever. Did that happen? You know, a bad
making shit up.
A bad debate performance kind of craters your
Perry's an example.
Or like Rick or Perry in 2012, right? Oops. But I do think they've had the effect that Claire describes. Also, though, haven't they just had the effect of kind of winnowing the field from 27, whatever it was, down to 10 or 12?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing.
Yeah.
I think because the primary has not been that dynamic, the debates have not mattered that much and vice versa.
Or maybe it would have been super dynamic if not for the debates.
I mean, the two things that have changed significantly, right, are Warren has been gaining throughout the primary and is now maybe co-front runner. And then Harris peaked as the result of one of the debates and then cratered. Has anything else happened that is like particularly dynamic in the race?
Buttigieg.
Well, I mean, slightly dynamic. Went from 2 to 8 and back down to 6 or something. I'm not sure that's that exciting.
One of those cases of dynamism is the result of a debate, but it kind of ended up not happening.
How important have the debates been for Warren? Because on the one hand, I think
very important.
She's had a consistent rise and has been the most consistent debater.
Yeah, I mean, 2 out of 3 debates we did polling for this fourth debate, by the way, also she did well on both of those, clearly like turning her into one of the front runners. I think the debates certainly haven't hurt and have probably helped. I know this debate I think is interesting. I'm actually kind of psyched about this debate.
Wait, why?
Because I think each of the three leading candidates in the polls have new factors to deal with. This is Biden's opportunity to respond to Ukraine, to Hunter Biden, to impeachment. He's become more forceful in his rhetoric and his social media recently after having been a little slow on the draw initially. Elizabeth Warren has to deal for the first time with the perception that she is the front runner. A lot of campaigns that thought, okay, well, let's attack Biden or trying to run our own lane. Now that might not be an option. She might get more critical questions from the media. We have seen a shift. We had this kind of Slack chat, was it last week, about like, is she getting favorable treatment from the media? My answer was, yeah, she has been on a good run. However, in the past week or so, there have been some stories that I thought were kind of a little bit thin in terms of reasons why she was getting critiqued, and that's a shift. And that will also affect the questions she gets and the candidates who approach her. And the third is Bernie Sanders had a heart attack since the past debate, and so people are going to be interested in how, frankly, healthy and vigorous he seems on the one hand. And on the other hand, like, kind of, is he moving into a stage where he is changing his strategy, maybe in a way to be more, what's the term people used of Hillary Clinton at the end of her campaign, like valedictory, right? Where it's kind of like at the end of the campaign where you're being a little bit more gracious. You're like, you know what, maybe I don't have a great shot, but I just want to kind of
get your approval rating back up?
Yeah, warm the part of my ideas.
What makes you think the Sanders will do that?
Well, to be frank, a lot of voters in polls have concerns about Bernie Sanders' health, and he's not doing that well. He's at 15% right now when you have two candidates at 29%, 28%. That's a pretty big gap to make up. When a lot of the voters who aren't voting for you now say, yes, a 78-year-old who just had a heart attack does give me a lot of concerns about things ranging from his health to his ability to beat Donald Trump. And I think now the fact that Warren has a fairly dedicated base of supporters and has more second choice support, and the fact that you have this new kind of health factor to overcome, it's just like it's a really big lift.
No, I totally agree with that. And actually, my first thought after seeing it was like, okay, maybe you could go into more of like a whatever that term you used was.
Yeah.
But I don't think the campaign has done anything to suggest that. There was like that one moment where they did something with their Iowa ads, but they have been pretty clear that they are still going for this thing. Now, maybe it's the type of thing where, like, up until the moment you're not, you have to go full force. But
you're a movement, not an individual.
I mean, ironically, like, I wonder
I think
if the
Sanders
more
in some ways is probably struggling on some level personally, but also you have this whole apparatus surrounding you and a lot of people probably within your inner circle who say
want you to continue.
I'm sure there's a lot of division of what should our strategy be, because there
tough.
Are.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there's some interesting directions you could go in, and I would think that a presidential campaign of that size and seriousness would be thinking through a lot of different options, including should he drop out and endorse someone, right?
Yeah, But again, they're not showing any.
Publicly, it is obviously full steam ahead.
Nate, when it comes to like the health stuff, we've been talking a bit about how all three of the front runners, so to speak, are septuagenarians, but it doesn't mean the same thing. And I think we actually got some polling recently that shows that the broader public sees, although they're all in their 70s, kind of see them differently. Can you explain kind of how that broke down?
Yeah, I think CBS / YouGov did polling on a variety of things related to Bernie Sanders' health and age. Asked voters, regardless of who you might consider, do you feel these candidates are too young to serve effectively as president, too old to serve effectively as president, or is their age not a concern? Only 4% of voters said Elizabeth Warren is too old. 28% said Joe Biden is too old. And 43% said Bernie Sanders is too old.
Wow.
That's very interesting. And what are their ages?
Warren is 70, but would be 71.
76 and 78, respectively.
And then would be 77.
Sanders and Biden are about a year apart. They happen to be in this gap right now where it's more like a year than 2 years.
I think the Warren, to me, is kind of like, she's just like, she projects.
She's fine.
Yeah. But like the interesting thing is, I would be curious before the heart attack what the Biden-Sanders two old numbers would be, because that is quite a big difference for those two.
Similar for Biden and Sanders, yeah.
I mean, those numbers are really striking. Now, you'd imagine they're somewhat inflated by the recency of the heart attack.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and maybe in a couple months, Sanders' numbers go down. And maybe Biden's goes down a little, too, just as sort of like being adjacent in age.
To be fair, 2% of voters said that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders were too young to be president.
I love that.
Those
are definitely trolls.
I once pitched a recurring column about like nonsensical poll results.
Where, to me, right?
Yeah, where it's like the 1 or 2 or 3 or 4% that just say like.
And I believe I said like, I don't want to spend my life doing that.
But you just said you love it. So now you have to.
Someone else should write that column.
Like the 4% of people who went into the 2016 election being like enthusiastic and
about
approving
both
Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Like, what a great segment of the population.
The
I would
who
love
see
to
the
meet
good
them.
In everyone.
How big of a problem is that 28% number for Biden? He's too old. Is that among Democrats?
It is a problem with young voters.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like something you just see across the board. Like he's
old.
Yeah. Like, and so if he becomes the nominee.
It's Democrats, by the way.
If he becomes the nominee, isn't that a problem? That some people are just kind of like, ugh, this guy.
But also,
right? Like the lack of connection that Biden has. You know, you watch him on the stump and he brings up Kennedy and going to the moon as his way of relating to young people, right? Of the idea of here, we need someone who can inspire movements. And his touchstone is President Kennedy saying we should go to the moon by the end of a decade, which I'm not saying wasn't an inspiring event, but the fact that he is pulling back to the early 60s in order to inspire the youth of 2019 is indicative of something.
I can't believe you're so against the space.
So I am so against.
Claire Malone hates space.
Actually, I like this is this an aside, but I legitimately loved Newt Gingrich's moon colony thing. I thought it was cool.
I love all space ideas.
I'm wearing a NASA t-shirt as we speak.
Wow.
Are you on camera this week?
Yeah,
we are on camera. Would you like to flash the
camera?
Wow. There you go, NASA.
I'm wearing a 538 shirt with Ted Cruz and Donald Trump on it.
Oh. Very nice. By the way, the people who did not just see Micah and Nate flash the cameras, I've gotten some messages recently asking when we're on ABC News Live if people want to watch. It's now 4:30 p.m. on Tuesdays. So if you want to see Nate and Micah flash those cameras, it's at 4:30
live
p.m. on
polls.
Tuesdays.
I still think we need to get that shirt that says live polls.
I want to do that. I really want to do that. But wait, Nate, you agree with that? That 28% is a problem?
Look, I mean,
it's not 50%.
It's not 50%. So Biden has 30% right now, roughly, probably 27, 28, right? Of the 30% he doesn't have, then like almost a third of those or more than a third of those voters have an issue with his age. That might be kind of people who I think are a little bit maybe off limits to him because it's kind of a fundamental issue that gets into like fitness for office and also ability to beat Trump. And Sanders currently has 15%. 43% say he's too old. Okay, that really reduces the chunk that he could get that's left. Let's say that Bernie Sanders makes a big comeback and the Elizabeth Warren people or the Biden people are not happy about this because it means they might not win the nomination and Bernie might instead. The heart attack did not get that much coverage, in part because it came when all these really important stories were going on, right? But, like, you can imagine Democratic surrogates for Biden or Warren kind of bringing it back up.
So, also, it's worth noting that since the heart attack, our colleague Nathaniel Rakich went back and looked at second choice polling, right? Basically, for people who like, for example, Biden, who do they prefer as their second choice? And it's now Elizabeth Warren. It used to be Bernie Sanders. So that's something that has also kind of shifted in the wake of the third debate, in the wake of Bernie Sanders' heart attack.
I was just fiddling around with the Real Clear Politics polling average. And it strikes me again, as we're going into the debate, that Andrew Yang is only polling within a couple points of Harris and Buttigieg. And I'm just thinking about age here. Yeah. Do you think part of the reason why Yang is polling well is just youth? Buttigieg, that's obviously part of his thing, but he's a more serious person. And we've talked a lot about Andrew Yang as kind of like, oh, he's a candidate of the internet. And I don't think people take him seriously as he's going to be the nominee. But I am struck by, right now in the averages, Biden, Warren, Sanders, then Buttigieg at 5, Harris at 4.5, Yang at 2.7. Is some of it just sheer, like, that young man has ideas? Just like the fact that Yang is such a weird candidate in so many ways, but is kind of polling like not bad at all.
No, he's doing pretty well.
I just want to know how much of that is just like the ambrosia of youth.
I think it's the pure, I'm apolitical people.
Yeah. He's like an outsider. He's the outsider.
Outsider, right? Yeah. Oh, college student doesn't like politics. This guy's kind of fun and cool. I guess if you were like a libertarian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Democrat. Anti-circumcision.
Anyway, yeah.
Anti-circumcision, right? But like, yeah.
What is the interpretation? So it's cited all the time. I think Nate cited this on This Week on Sunday yesterday, that the three leading candidates are all in their 70s. On the one hand, we have these polls that show people are expressed concerned about the leading candidates' ages. On the other hand, they're the leading candidates. How to reconcile those things?
Okay, in so such a big field, your national recognition, like your name ID, is super important.
And those were the three leading.
I'm sorry. I think it's more than name ID. I think that's part of it. But I think it's like a true worry that swing voters will get spooked by some of the new faces, or like they might embody, rightly or not, like the new scary socialist Democratic Party. Like, I think there's some like steady as she goes. Like, even though Warren is very left, there's some sense of like, oh, I don't know. Like, that person seems like they would play well and competent and be able to kind of like code switch Oklahoma with
voters. Voters do not think Elizabeth Warren's age is an issue per that polling we cited earlier in the segment. And so she has moved up because age isn't a concern. Meanwhile, Bernie.
Women do live longer than men.
So it's not.
That's important.
Okay, so that's how you reconcile.
I think voters are saying. Meanwhile, Bernie has been very flat and is getting a lot less than he got last time.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to know how much age factors into that. I tend to think if Bernie Sanders were 10 years younger, he would have been regarded in a very different way from the start. And Biden's been Biden. He's doing okay. I mean, we had an article pointing out Biden has not actually declined in the polls, really, post-Ukraine. He's been pretty steady. But, like, he hasn't expanded his coalition either. He hasn't gotten that many, although he's more than anyone else, like, endorsers, right? He hasn't kind of persuaded people who weren't in his camp originally, and you wonder if age might be a concern there. And he has not been very sharp in these debates.
That just suggests to me, though, I think that's right in your point about Warren sort of not shouldn't really count towards the old people leading. I think that's right. But I think that does highlight the extent to which concern about age, quote unquote, we shouldn't take it literally. It's more symbolic. It's more about how virile someone seems or how energetic they seem, how sharp they seem.
Right. It's all about appearance. It's a campaign through television.
My point is just you can change that. Yeah. You can't change your age. You know.
All right. Well, we've talked a lot about some of the broader dynamics in the race, and we'll see what actually comes up in the debate. It would be really interesting, I think, if you were to watch like Warren, Biden, and Sanders kind of go at each other about the issue of age, or, you know, some of the others really take them to task on age. We don't know whether or not
that will happen. Someone should make the pass the torch argument again.
Somebody did, and he dropped out.
Where's Swalwell when you need him?
All right. Anyway, so we're going to be live blogging tomorrow, Tuesday night. So check us out at 538.com. We'll also have a reaction podcast for you in your feeds afterwards. But let's leave it there.
The only thing I would add is we are again doing that cool polling with Ipsos to track what people think of the debate and to track how the debate changes the horse race. We'll have our before picture going up Tuesday morning, and we'll have the after picture going up midday Wednesday.
And so we don't care about any other candidates apart from the top three?
Nope. That's a wrap.
I care about them.
Sorry, Tulsi Gabbard, Tom Steyer, Cory Booker.
You started at the bottom. Better way you're up.
Pete Buttigieg, Tom Steyer.
All right, let's leave things there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And again, before we let you go, we're going to have a teaser of Hot Takedown after the credits, so stick around. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong. A message relayed in a tweet by Rockets general manager Daryl Morey has plunged the NBA into a geopolitical scandal. This is far from the first time that the NBA has wandered into politics. But this weekend, we saw a different response from NBA officials.
Chinese politics are a massive deal now in the NBA. And I think the reason is Chinese money and 500 million people that watched at least one NBA game last year.
You know, comparing this with what the NFL has kind of dealt with, when the protests during the national anthem was happening at the start of the 2017 season, we did some research. And what we found was there was no apparent relationship between how popular or unpopular Trump was in an area and the support that football had. It was a universal sport, basically. The NBA, by contrast, was the sport that had the most negative correlation between support for Trump and popularity of the sport. In other words, it was the one with the biggest liberal fan base and support. So when somebody like LeBron have spoken out against Trump, it does carry less of a risk. In some ways, it builds the brand more than anything else.
It's really, to me, the first time they've really faced a battle between the league's values as it relates to this country and the idea of like how much money do we stand to lose if we take a certain stance on this.
So does this incident reveal that the image of the NBA as a politically progressive league was maybe always a little bit misleading, that it was maybe a little bit more for in issues where it wasn't going to cost them anything? Or is it just more that we're realizing the limits of that progressive status?